what happened at the LCA convention. There's all kinds of ways of saying it. I won't try to say it any other way than I just did. We have as initiators of part of our discussion, three panelists up front here, Bishop Chilstrom and Mr. Deal and President Anderson, whom you all, I assume, are acquainted with. Do we have to give B time for each one? Bishop from Minnesota Synod, Bill from Bethlehem Steel, and Southern Seminary of the LCA, George. I'm moderator, my name's Al LeWitt. How many of you are from the LCA? Can we pull a whole LCA crowd out? Are there anybody, is there anyone here who's not from the LCA? We've already said something about church conventions. I know that there are a couple of people here who served as delegates to the convention, in addition to some of the folks up front. Who else, is there anyone here who will admit to being a delegate to the LCA? There are several. Well, let me explain a little bit what we try to mean by a forum, and that is that we invite general discussion. It's not a lecture, it's not a review in the sense of, you know, going through all the things, in this instance, all the things that happened. But if we can get to some issue that has interest that a good number of folks are willing to talk about, that's what the forum is about. We don't know what those issues might be yet, we will be searching for them. And we hope to get some ideas from both from you as well as from the folks up front. I'll serve as moderator, to keep it focused, and I do promise you that at about 2 minutes to 10, we'll wrap up the discussion. At 10 o'clock we'll end, and if people will want to continue to chat, we can do that informally afterwards. So we do have a timeline, and I'll do my best to serve in that capacity. I'd like to start off as a moderator just by asking, is someone willing to say, what's the purpose of a church convention? I mean that seriously. I hope you'll be willing to treat that seriously. Why is there such a thing as an LCA convention? It's required, I assume, by your documents.
That's the chief decision-making element in the church, and therefore there are some decisions which only the church can make in convention. In a participatory church, it's important for the folks to get together and to be able to make those decisions.
Okay, anyone else?
It's a worship experience too, and a fellowship time for people to come here. I think that's an extremely important element in a convention, at least I hear that. Both synodically and in the national convention, especially for lay people, they in fact come back as visitors sometimes just because of the inspiration of a convention.
Decisions are made, there's a worship experience. When decisions are made, who does what? What are the results of the convention? Somebody has decided something, who does what is decided? Is it something that's binding on everyone? Is it something directed to congregations? Is it something that tells boards and agencies what to do, or is it all of the above, or what? In other words, when you get done with it and decisions are made, who does what?
You're on the executive. Part of it is really almost pro forma. There's a constitutional requirement for the various agencies of the church to report to the convention of their activities in the prior 2 years. You go through the almost pro forma business of approving a budget, which has virtually no opportunity for adjustment in it. There are certain things that are just done as a matter of function. But then there are things that are done that do make a difference. There's a lot of memorials from synods that have to be dealt with. They at times generate work for the church agencies in the next 2 years. There's certain decision the convention has to make that result in new directions, new programs, new positions.
Okay. Some of them aren't binding, although they are encouraging. For example, we've undertaken the 10 years more extension of our hunger appeal, and that doesn't mean everybody has to contribute to us. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean it will be pursued.
Oh, please. Well, I was going to suggest that maybe Maybe you could explain the terminology of memorialize. It sounds like somebody's died. The first time I was at the convention, I heard about that.
Another word would be a petition, I guess. Each of our 33 synods meets in convention, and then they have two opportunities to petition the LCA at large to do something, or take a position on something, or not to do something. And how many do we have?
148.
148 memorials to deal with. And some of them were very similar. There were quite a few on world hunger, quite a few on South Africa. So they have to be dealt with by the convention, because the petition to the convention.
Two more questions, and then I would hope that you could just raise your hand if you want to say anything at any time. You don't have to wait even till the end. Could I ask each of you to say what do you think was the pop questions, the things that have gotten the notoriety or that were popularized about the convention? What were the most popular issues or a popular issue? And then one that you thought was a very serious issue, maybe the same thing. But I think I heard about some just because the convention took place. I wasn't sure those were the crucial issues of the convention or not. So I'd like to hear one and the other, if you wouldn't mind. The fair would be anybody?
Well, I think obviously one of the popular issues was the bishop question. That was characterized by the fact that when the vote was taken, the observers from the magazines over on the right side rushed up to the stairs that led up to the front of the convention to check and see how the vote was going. But I don't think that was the significant decision of the convention. I think it was really quite a minor decision. I think the adoption of the statement on economic justice was very significant and worked through carefully. Some felt too painstakingly by the convention, but it was a working convention at that point, and one sensed a great feeling of unanimity and almost celebration of an accomplishment when that was worked out and finally this is it and adopted by the convention.
Bill, you have similar things or what?
Well, I would pick certainly a hotly debated issue. There were two that got a lot of coverage that way. One was the South Africa question, which was a two-part one against apartheid, and the other was divestment of stock, which we held in companies that issue. And the other hot issue was a kind of in-house thing, which had to do with our pension plan and how inclusive it was to be. And many hours were spent on those. The one that interests me partly because of my own involvement and concern was the Lutheran Unity action, which adopted a process for continued study and sort of polling of the three church bodies that are involved now in discussing cross-border consolidation.
Okay. How about you?
I feel good about the statement on economic justice because I saw the evolvement of that. The initial draft of the statement was one that dealt with current economic situations and as it was making its way around the country with lay people responding to it, got a lot of very negative reaction. People feeling that it was communistic inspired and all kinds of negative things. So the final statement took a different direction. It became a rather general statement of a theological position that says that as the believers, we are led to be concerned for economic justice. It's a good theological statement, I think, and it is general. Now, the next step is that now we will begin to deal with specific issues, and people can attack those specific issues and fight and jump up and down about positions on those isolated issues. But the statement is in place, and we have said that, yes, we do have a concern for economic justice in the world, and this is the way we look at it. So I think it's a very good way of getting the statement out in somewhat pure and isolated form, Now we'll deal with the nitty-gritty things of openness of welfare and multinational corporations and all those issues that divide people and argue about, rather than to try to put them in the initial statement. I think that was a good thing. I did feel badly about the way in which we handled the South Africa. I felt that in view of the fact that there was ample indication that there would be debate on that, that we had not, we, the convention, had not been prepared to deal with some of the factual material in a forum or something like that prior to the debate going on. Because a lot of people were voting on that without a great deal of knowledge about the true situation, and there was a lot of emotion there. And I think the planners of the convention could have done a better job in planning for forums prior to that debate.
I wonder what the delegates.
Yeah.
What did you see as
big
issues?
I thought that your group immunity was going to be a big issue on the board. It didn't have a comment or a question. Did that surprise you?
It never has in the 6 years that we dealt with it. There really has not been much discussion. There usually have been one or two persons speaking favorably. But I thought this time we might get some negative response, because in the hearing we had some questions about dilly-dally.
What was the question? I didn't hear it.
Would you repeat again, Ron?
Well, I just asked if they were surprised that the question of the Lutheran unity was dealt with so quickly. Okay. No questions or comments.
I was surprised too, because I think there's some unhappiness with the pace. I thought there might be an attempt to set a date for a formal merger. That didn't materialize. I know at least one Synod president who has been very open about opposing Lutheran merger, and I thought something might come out of that Synod, but not a word.
Maybe it was so late in the convention.
That's what I missed. Well, what's the interpretation of that? If there are no questions, does that mean they're all satisfied, or they don't care, or is it late in the convention?
My observation for that was that there was an awful lot of discussion in the forums and hearings regarding that, where there was a lot of communication going to that. That helped me personally with that.
Was that pretty good? Much good and give and take, did you feel?
A great deal in the hearings.
That's a fairly new wrinkle for us at conventions, is to have these forums and hearings. What, about three conventions or so, I guess. And, really seems to pay off. It should have been South Africa.
Yes, please.
I'd like to know what your sense of what the church is excited about that came out of the convention.
Question?
Well, I would respond as a layperson and as a delegate to that convention. Certainly, as I heard people talking and heard some of the issues being raised, a very serious attempt for inclusion, including people from all races and colors and not quite all creeds, but certainly that was emphasized too, the going out and reaching out toward other people. And I guess that sort of posture is one that I have not heard expressed so deeply by delegates, by some of the presentations. It was the 10th anniversary of the National Indian Lutheran Board. That was expressed. Or Nation of Women as well. Certainly there was a great amount of emotion on the floor when the divestment issue was being discussed, and some feelings that we should be very careful about the symbolic nature of our action as it related to our black brothers and sisters on the convention floor. That whole notion of inclusion, I think, is exciting to me as I look at the whole church.
Thank you.
I could echo that theme of inclusion as I looked at the ability of a single delegate being able to present a motion, have it acted on favorably by the convention, and I'm thinking specifically of one particular woman who submitted a resolution to have the past social statements editorialized for inclusive language, which was adopted by the convention, and echoing that kind of thing.
How about the rest of you? What's the church excited about?
I'm prejudiced.
Yeah. Speak of prejudice.
Well, I am excited to see the way in which the renewal of laity seems to be developing in the NCA, the last ministry movement. But I'm so close to it that I don't see the whole scene, so I can't talk about that.
What's your prejudice, Herb?
I think there's an excitement in the church that I didn't see surface at the convention. That is evangelical outreach, and especially the Word and Witness program, which I have found very instrumental in many parishes in bringing about renewal. And I don't know why, maybe the convention is not a place where a thing like that comes to the surface. Maybe I just wasn't in the right place at the right time. There was no formal mention of that that I recall. But it's happening in parishes, and that's very exciting.
Well, I'll take a different tack and say I think there's a kind of a haunting feeling. As the budget was presented and at other times about how we're going to manage as a national or international church in the next decade. It's nothing to get excited about, but it seemed to be something that at least struck me again and again as a real concern as to how we are going to adjust to what's probably going to be a difficult economic decade for the church.
Well, you got a sharp drop there just 2 years away, don't you? The strength for mission funds run out?
Yes, the budget is going to be. And there were efforts to add certain programs or studies, and they were uniformly turned away because they couldn't find extra dollars for them.
I'm just curious, what is the national budget? What are we talking about?
Just short of 50 million, 47 million.
And what do you foresee down the road then as far as when the parish has started from that? What does that look like?
Well, as Bill mentioned, Strength for Mission had our mission appeal generated a good deal of money, and they've been starting missions in a much livelier manner than had been the case a few years before, and I think we'll probably return to a slower pace. And also, more mission money is going into this inclusiveness concern. That is, we are really trying to put more money into missions in minority settings. That means slow growth. It's not one of these instant, pay for yourself in 5 years kinds of things. So that sort of thing, and then also strengthening congregations that are in urban areas and so on. Ministry in foreign with minorities.
George, I'm speaking from memory, but isn't that $50 million? Isn't perhaps 15, 12, 15 million of that strength commission money?
I don't remember the figures,
but I think it is
a sizable chunk of it. Is that in
we're looking at? We've been running around a $35-38 million budget, and then you put strength commission money on top of that, covering 2 to 3 years of use. But then it's going to fall off, and I think the church is facing a very serious programmatic decision in the next 2 years, in 1984, in 1982, because that money won't be there, and we haven't made up for it in terms of additional giving.
Well, one of the signs of hope there is that many synods are undertaking an every parish intensive stewardship program. Instead of having a special appeal, say, for seminaries or colleges or what have you, there's a very deliberate, very carefully planned program that will reach down to the individual in every parish. And we're hoping that will upgrade every level of support. Some centers are realizing as much as 18-20% increase in benevolence in 1 year. And our hope is that will happen in many of our centers.
Thank you.
someone articulate what really did, what action was taken on South Hadley.
No, I'm not the best man.
Well, what happened? He's just asking what did take place.
All right, there was an effort made, a coalition, I forget the exact title, Coalition for Disinvesting in South of Africa, it's called, wanted to get before the convention a stipulation that that we would disinvest, pull out all church funds from any agencies, banks, whatever, having business in South Africa within a year if nothing happened to change the situation in South Africa. The Vision for Mission North America already has the option of doing that. And so I think they became a little defensive because people were saying, well, nothing's happening. And so the final vote was not to have that one-year requirement, to continue to give our Division for Mission North America the option of total disinvestment if they think that's appropriate. Now, to me, and I didn't know anything about it, to me, the question was, well, where are we? You know, how much time is left? And I learned a little bit more about that at one of the breakfasts the next day in terms of, you know, South Africa is on the verge of explosion, and virtually all the efforts that could be made have been made, and yet DMA feels we still have some opportunities of doing some more things. So the issue really was in terms of, have we exhausted all the opportunities and possibilities, and people felt that we haven't. The one remaining thing we have is that gesture to people of South Africa by saying, you know, it is the end, and we at least stand by you by pulling out all money that we have connected to South Africa. I'm not correcting you.
No,
you only say that it was a very close vote.
That's what I want to ask.
It was a 17-vote difference.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Which way did it go?
It went against this, I mean, this proposal for the more immediate divestment, and in other words, favored keeping our options open.
Yeah, I want to just express, it might be more feeling than fact, and then you can respond. I was disappointed when I heard how that vote went. Part of the disappointment was there was a South African pastor there at the convention. I went to a lunch, and there were like 16 there. And he felt that he knew the mood of the church and the Christians, the Lutheran Christians of South Africa and Namibia, that there was no question in his mind that for the Lutheran Church in America to express solidarity with the Lutheran Christians in South Africa, there really wasn't any option except to vote for divestment. My problem was why the convention wasn't, you've already answered this partially, but why wasn't the convention rushing to him to find out what the South African Christians were saying? And it's very hard for me not to see this as a subtle form of racism, of the old problem we have of thinking we know more what is good for them than they, rather than listening to what they might have to say to us. And if this is the case, and in my mind there are indications that it is, it's pointed that I'm disappointed in my church. I don't know how now we can communicate to Lutheran brothers and sisters in Namibia and South Africa that we are with them and that we listen more to them than we do to our own society and culture and corporations. And I'm struggling for some way to tell them we still care about them, because I think symbolically this vote is sending them a very definite message about where we still are as American Lutheran Christians. And I know there's a lot of guts tied up in what I'm saying, but I'm interested in a response.
Any response? Well,
I would respond in two ways. One, I attended a hearing on the President's report, Bishop's report, and Bishop Crumley indicated on this particular issue that he had spoken with two bishops from Africa within a short period of time, each of whom had a totally different posture. One is saying this, this invest, and the other one is saying, no, don't. That's one point of view. Another point of view, and this is something that the delegates certainly had a lot of discussion about. If we disinvest, we pull ourselves out of an arena where we can at least carry on some discussion. I think Bill Lazarus at the convention carried a lot of weight in talking about, I think the words he uses, being down in the dirty streets, with the corporations and the companies having at them, those companies and corporations, those banks where we have investments, going after them and talking to them about their policies, about their investment in South Africa. If we disinvest, if we sell everything we have, then we have nothing, we have no cards in our hand. There's no way that we can go and talk with the corporations. That was a very strong point of view. I think we can say to our black brothers and sisters that we are totally opposed to apartheid. We do not wish to invest in corporations and banks and companies that are doing business in South Africa, but we will continue to have dollars there so we can get them at every step of the way. Now, that's what I understood as being an important position for the church.
How does it compare with the United Church of Christ that's already divested 2 years ago, and also the Methodists? They've taken that step already. And we as Lutherans have a much heavier commitment as far as membership. Being 80% Lutheran in Namibia, and then we don't even support it. I think that's real strange.
No.
No,
I think
not.
No, the ALC
has.
No, not yet. They're voting that in their district conventions and it comes to the...
Recommended.
It has been recommended.
Yeah, I hear some perhaps tones, maybe I'm reading something that isn't there, tones that there was not an interest or concern. I didn't have that feeling. The issue was the way in which to do it. I think that's the way the people were voting. What is the best strategy? I didn't get the impression that people were saying, we're not interested in South Africa. It was a matter of strategy. And you talk about pulling money out. Well, the DWME, didn't you go to that DWME breakfast following the next morning?
I went to two breakfasts. Well, I also went to the session that Dan's talking about where the black was talking.
Oh.
And there was very little participation. It was poorly represented. I thought the leaders even showed a slump in their thinking. I thought it was poor, just showed lack of interest. And people were absolutely, had no information about it. They have very peculiar and really dumb questions that they asked, which showed they knew so little.
Yeah. The fellow Dita Bean did a great job of giving some history and population breakup and breakdown and so on. Very, very good. Very helpfully pointing out that the Lutheran Church and the Dutch Reformed Church in South Africa are the only two churches where you have a white and black church. We're not integrated in South Africa, so part of it's hanging on our back too. But what was interesting to me was the point of the DWME people saying, think of the money we're putting in and stay there, because we are using a lot of funds through Lutheran World Ministries for legal aid for people in South Africa who were in prison, so on, finding ways to help get them out. And this fellow was expressing the feeling that that is showing a lot of support and solidarity when we're bringing people in to help get these people out of prison.
If I could pick up the complexity of what Dan was driving at a moment ago, a year ago at our Synod Convention in Minnesota, the issue was on the floor. And someone who was pushing hard for pulling out our investments noticed that there was an African black person from South Africa as a visitor, invited or requested the convention to let this person speak, assuming that the person would agree with that position. And that person came to the microphone and gave the exact opposite position and said, don't pull out your investment because that will affect the livelihood of my friends back in South Africa. So
no,
that convention we voted against divestiture. This year came up again and voted, as I remember, rather solidly in favor of divestment. Really complex.
One thing this pastor mentioned, that the South African Christians, even in the very last year, really made a turn on this because they're they're telling us now, true, it will hurt us if you, you know, if American corporations pull out, it will hurt the blacks the most, but we want, we need to go through that suffering in order for the system to break down.
Yeah, I have a couple questions. I was involved with the youth condo and so observed quite a bit of the convention, and I was disturbed by a couple things that went on during the divestiture debate. One was that I noticed the close vote, but I also noticed that 40 to 50 delegates weren't present for that vote. Is that, do you think that's correct? Because I think the total was only 620 or 30, and there were 680 some delegates. And I was really concerned about that, that we could make a decision that was so close with that many delegates and absent from the vote. And also, I was concerned that as far as the way the convention functioned, Bill Lazarus held a lot of sway in taking us through the ethical analysis of the problem and saying that we don't want to pull out just to keep our hands clean, but we want to do what's most effective. We want to make our love effective in the world. So I thought the natural consequence of that remark would be to outline why just having divestiture as an option was the most effective way of dealing with the problem. And I never heard any of the facts on the convention floor. And I guess I share your concern that there was no hearing where the actual facts, and it seemed like we were trusting in a sort of expert testimony from DMNA that they knew what was best in the situation. And I felt ignorant and uninformed to make a decision. And I was just a visitor. I can imagine, you know, the delegates. I don't know. Do you have any comments about that? Or?
I would just comment on the latter sense that we sort of left it to the Division of Mission in North America. I think that's probably accurate. I think that, first of all, there was a lot of confusion as to what the best thing to do might be. And I think in a situation like that, people tend to say, let's keep the options open. And therefore, they did what allowed both, it was, you can still say, divestment is possible. And otherwise, we were very unilateral. And I think people in a tension situation tend to try to find that kind of way out and then say, well, let the experts decide when and where. And that would relate to that. I think that there is hope for continued advocacy of that position to the division. Because that is, in fact, an option. They're going to have to show that they're serious about it, and that if they meant what they said, then there will be some cases in which divestment ought to occur, and they probably, persons feel that way, ought to be encouraged to do it.
Patty, is there an index?
I agree with the panelist's judgment on the virtues of the economic justice statement, which I think is a tremendous potential for future use. What bothered me about it was there was nothing equivalent in terms of what inflation is doing, either in the local parish or in the Senate or in the church at large. So we're talking about pension funds, and they're shrinking every day in terms of purchasing power. And I realize that the churches are not old economic schools, but you got an awful lot of people that are very opinionated about what pensions ought to happen, ought to be, and how, where they ought to go, and they're really economically naive. And I think a little bit that even spilled over into this issue, because if we did not begin to have an equivalent discussion of the problem of black churches in this country and their problems.
Can you respond? Dennis?
Well, I was going to go back to South Africa and ask for a clarification. Did the church have authority to disinvest prior to this convention?
That's my understanding.
Yes.
I thought that this convention added the option and that they did not have it prior to this convention. There was no authority for them to ever do that until this convention. So if my interpretation is correct, there was a positive, maybe halfway step taken. But I thought this convention added the option that they didn't have before. Maybe, and that's what Lazarus was arguing for. He said, give us, he said, it's better at this point to give us the threat of disinvestment. And my assumption in all the reading and everything else was that this was a new option.
I thought this was a recommendation the Executive Council approved last fall.
That's the root, that the Executive Council approved it, but now the church essentially adopted and ratified it.
I would doubt whether it was anything new given. In the sense that having and presently sitting on the board of an institution that invests money, the board has the right to change its investments anytime it wants to, and that we can call disinvestment, whatever the word is, but we don't usually call it that. We just call it prudent management of the funds of the institution. I don't think they got anything new from what little I understand of that action. They had it before.
Just by virtue of their authority, isn't it?
Yeah, their responsibility to invest. Yes, please.
Does the LCA own a controlling interest in any of the corporations concerned?
We really tried. Our IBM, our fraction of IBM, for example, is so small that even when all the churches combined in a stockholder action at IBM, we still are so small a fraction that we don't make a dent at a stockholder.
So what was the argument then for remaining within the invested stockholder group? I mean, is there any practical power behind vote, or would it be more rhetoric?
No, in many cases, in order to avoid a fight on the floor of a stockholder meeting, for example, and not only that, let's say, but that's one way in which we have been able as a church to go to various oil companies, for example, and talk to them about policies relating to Southern Africa, and they have taken action or responded, even though we are a small group. Sometimes all they need is a little encouragement and help. Other times they see it as bad PR if they don't respond, and in some cases there have been issues brought to the floor of a stockholders meeting, and enough ruckus was caused to make them want to talk with the group afterwards and try to work out some amicable solution. So even though we don't have a lot of power, we can make some noise.
And the banks also were there.
The banks too, yes, they responded.
Metropolitan New York Synod, I think, can they give an example that they did pull their money from one of the banks that was making investments, loan in South Africa, and they sat down and talked to the bank, and the bank said they made a change in policy, and would they be willing to put their money back in the bank again? So that was given as an example of how some, it's admittedly small, but with some kind of, people were listening a little bit to what little pressure we did have.
Another point, too, that was made, Bill Lazarus told us about, talked about seeing connections. We were hearing about that earlier tonight. He said, okay, you divest. Where do you reinvest? Where do you put your money that's absolutely morally clean? What do you put in government securities or treasury notes and so on? Well, what do you do? That's part of being in a society. Where do you find those clean investments?
The Holden Village Foundation.
You got to compromise emergency.
Before I lose it, I think you made a couple of comments earlier that are interesting about how conventions operate. You were dismayed that 50 people weren't there. Frankly, I think that's a high percentage of people to be present at any time.
It was an evening extra session, if I remember. The air conditioning had broken down.
But I think in fairness, too, you have to realize that when that many hundreds of people are at a convention, you've always got a certain number of them that have got something else going besides the convention at a given time. that percentage wouldn't discourage me. The other observation, I think, may be more discouraging, and that is that it is a fact that most conventions are shaped by a relatively small number of people.
Yeah.
60% of the people at convention with August for the first time.
Right.
How many?
60% when we're delegates for the first time. That's generally the pattern. That's good and it's bad. It's good in the sense that new people are participating. Decision making is bad because they really sit back and feel they aren't qualified to participate in direct action. So
by the time they are, the convention's over.
What happened on the issue? Maybe you talked about this before I got back over here. It was about children. Yeah. Adoptable children in the insurance program. Yeah. Did you cover that before I go here?
No. Thank you.
We were waiting until you came.
What's the issue so everyone knows?
The issue is whether to exclude people who have a pre-existing condition. And I'll try, and you fellows. What we ended up with was a compromise, which is something like the following, that at the time of entry, everyone who has a pre-existing condition, no matter what it is, that condition will be excluded from coverage for a two-year period. Was it 2 years?
2 years.
We debated 1 and 2, but for a two-year period. However, no one will be excluded from the plan. In other words, it's an exclusion of condition and not person.
And not permanent exclusion of condition.
Right. After that two-year period, then everything is covered, no matter what the condition.
So that means people who adopt handicapped children, after 2 years, the children will be covered for everything, and up to that point would be covered for everything except the handicap.
This is only adopted.
Everyone.
The issue, though, was adopted children, maybe, because already the plan covers other children.
But anyone who comes into the plan with some pre-existing thing,
right,
that would be excluded for the two-year period, no matter what it was. Is that right?
Yes, with a severe asthmatic condition, for example, for the first 2 years, he would not be covered for medication.
Is that just an actuarial thing that they just pick 2 years?
Yeah, I think that's really what it amounts to.
Go ahead.
I had another question about some debate they had on the word rebellion in the economic justice statement. And I was wondering what repercussions you think it may have as far as aid. I know we already give aid to people who are involved in liberation activities in certain countries for humanitarian purposes. I'm wondering if you think that carefully worded statement will have much effect.
You better explain the statement. One part in the statement, economic justice, there is a section on redress, that if an economic system, there is the kind of oppression that cannot be corrected through normal channels, that gave steps which people could proceed to correct that injustice, even in certain cases, rebellion. And of course the word rebellion struck sparks with a number of people. There's a fair amount of debate on using those words. Should we use force instead of rebellion, or so on and so on? I was kind of interested in some of the Canadians stood on the floor and said, it's interesting to us to realize that 2 days before the 4th of July, you people are arguing whether it's inappropriate to have rebellion under economic circumstances. So the word rebellion was used, and I don't think it's going to be a problem, but
anyone else? Reaction?
That was used to imply both violent and nonviolent means.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I don't think it's going to be a problem, but for a negative reason. I don't think that statement is ever going to get down into the parish in such a form that it's ever going to be debated. A few folks may pick it up and read it, but I don't see it ever surfaces.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think, as it stands right now, I don't think that statement will get tremendous attention. But I'm hoping that the follow-up issue statements that we work on are going to strike enough sparks that people will be forced to go to the statement that we just acted on as the keystone of our whole theology of involvement in the area of economics, saying we must be concerned about economic justice in the global system.
What if things do blow up in the next few years in South Africa, and we're called on a DWME to help fund more direct activities, not just, you know, humanitarian activities as swap or, you know, peace or intermediate. Won't this statement provide the authority for that funding now that we've included violence in that statement? I'm just wondering if you think that may be the case.
Anybody? Oh, situation ethics. That's the situation, I suppose.
I'm curious about the things that Bill is saying, which I think includes what you're saying too. How does the LCA prepare for conflict? Is it good at it? I mean, is it asking for it when these statements come out? The assumption that the vote was very close even on that issue. It seems to me the battle isn't over, maybe oughtn't be. You haven't resolved anything. How many people changed their minds at the convention? Ought there be that process? How do you go about that? If you're going to stir up folks, and I would think a good cause and good commitment to stir them up, how are you ready to handle, or is that not dealt with? How do you handle conflict? Or is that not what it's about? It seemed to me a number of times we were saying that that's what we were trying to do, stir up folks who were thinking one way and getting them over to another way. What? That means conflict down the pipe.
I don't know how to respond to that, Elmer, but let me just tell you a little bit about my own experience at the convention, which was take an issue such as the South Africa thing. I tried to be a responsible delegate, did lots of reading, talked with people, some that I regarded as having some expertise in the issue, and came prepared to vote one way. I felt that the discussions, even though there wasn't a hearing on that particular issue, I thought the debate was such, we were all given red and green cards to hold up to show how we were going to vote. I thought the debate was so lively and good on that particular issue that, I was switching my colors. At one point I wanted to hold them both up. Now that doesn't really answer your question, but it was an indication of the kind of spirit of debate that was going on. And I think a lot of delegates were struggling with a lot of those issues in that same way, and there was an openness to have one's mind change. I didn't feel there was a lot of stubborn advocacy and that people were willing to listen and to be open.
I felt that the best speech given from the floor on the convention was given on that issue by Bishop Brinjar of the Slovak Zion Center, who did a masterful job of being sensitive to the feeling of some people we ought to pull out immediately, and yet who came out saying he felt that we ought to hold on to our investments or keep the option open. I think as many people were swayed by him if they were on the edge, as were by Bill Lazarek. And that goes back to what you say about a few people with the right speech at the right time can really tilt the convention.
Elmer, you said something about conflict, which resonated within me. I came away from that convention for a real appreciation of what I would identify as a Lutheran value of conflict, valuing conflict, that you can have differing points of view, opposing points of view, and you respect each other's point of view. I guess I'm very tired in this milieu in which we live of single issue positions, the right, the absolute right, and the absolute wrong, and the moving away from each other. And although there were opposing points of view shared on that convention floor, there was a real unity of spirit and respect and I'm not sure how many problems we solved, but there was certainly a good, healthy exchange of positions and ideas. I really took away from that an appreciation for opposing points of view and an appreciation for conflict, that it's okay to have conflict, that we need not resolve everything. Maybe the best thing that we can do is agree to disagree.
Probably why that worship thing gets so important in all of it, too.
Yes, very much so.
Good, please.
I was disappointed in the convention's vote on the South African issue. From what I understand, I'm not Lutheran, but from what I understand of the different synods, what I gather is that the LCA tends to be, in quotes, one of the most liberal synods. And I thought that if they were going to set an example of faithfulness for the other synods, the LCA convention this fall on the issue, that it would be wonderful if that happened at this convention. I was disappointed, but I'm afraid I wasn't terribly surprised. It seemed to be one more instance of people's economic self-interest weighing so heavily in the pragmatics of an issue where that, I think, in the long run, won over what the indigenous people were saying. And I've been reading an African newspaper for a year trying to understand the situation in South Africa. From what I understand from people who have lived there, from statements of men such as Steve Biko, who died at the hands of South African police in a police station a couple years ago. He was the leader of the Black Consciousness Movement. His statement on the option of disinvestment was that there were only two options in South Africa. Either other nations disinvested in South Africa, or there was going to be one of the most bloody, violent revolutions the world's seen in South Africa in only a matter of years. His personal stance was to work as a pacifist in that situation. But he saw that the conflict was coming to the point of if the system was not torn apart by a lack of support on a world economic basis, that the only option was going to be violence. And I would say that my reading in the African newspaper has borne that out. The stories I've read of young black people being more and more willing to look down the muzzle of a gun and more willing to take up a gun, which has not been the case in South Africa for many decades. I think that the time is so short that by the time it's an issue again, I'm afraid that the love of that may have begun. And I think that we're sending a lot of double statements to the African people.
I'd like to add to that. When you talked about the issue whether or not to disinvest, it almost came across to me anyway that if we pulled out that left us totally out of the picture and we didn't have anything left to do. And I don't think that's it at all. I see a lot of options that I haven't seen used. We could play a big role in educating just the general public, other investors. I think if we're going to be effective, it's got to be in large numbers. And I haven't seen the church doing enough, educating enough, working on getting other people to pull out at the same time. I don't think we give up our options if we pull out. And I don't see how participating in that sin is giving us any extra options.
Without any effort to play down your feelings about it, almost half of the convention agreed with you, or at least apparently, by the vote, it was that close. So at least there were that many people who were that sensitive or committed in your direction, and at least at that moment.
Again, it was not a matter of saying we won't disinvest. The issue was whether we would agree to do it within a year. That would definitely be done. It may still be done within a year. We don't know. We're leaving it up to some other DM&A.
The impression I got from some people was that a lot of people came away from that debate and after that long evening and session, I guess saddened. I don't know, you know, it didn't matter which way they voted, but just that it was such a.
Yeah.
They came away sad. I think the whole convention did, and especially the people who voted for the best attorney that didn't win, but I think everybody did.
We have a minute. Anyone else? Comment? Question?
think that comment about sadness, I just would say that maybe that proved the seriousness with which the moral dilemma was faced. And I recognize some would not see it as a dilemma, but I think the feeling of a Christian faced with the difficulties in making such a decision, one cannot be satisfied no matter how it comes out, and one feels the need for forgiveness. If it had gone the other way, I think the same kinds of sort of, that we really, I don't know that there would have been a victory celebration.
I hate to be economically stupid, but are the monies that are invested in South Africa mostly the pension plan?
I don't think there are hardly any pension funds invested in South Africa. I think it's mostly DMNA, isn't it?
It's all invested in American corporations,
yes.
Banks, and so on. Not direct. We're not running gold mines.
I promise that we'd close on time. I want to say thanks to you, all of you, for participating, being here this evening, especially to our little panelists up front. Thanks much.